constructive project for one of our water-directed institutes concerned with critical water availability to move for the voluntary, even legislative adoption of such information to be listed not just on food products, but on every product and its packaging, from smartphones to computers to automobiles, from metal, paper, and wood products, iron, steel, and aluminum, from fracking to the cooling of nuclear generators and our houses and offices, from the growing of all things eaten and from all beverages imbibed. Truth in labeling. It's time for us to know and publicly declare how the circles and cycles of water work on our consummate behalf and how we must protect and recycle that essential value as the key ingredient in our future sustenance. Let's certify water. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
By some hole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, why the North Koreans refuse to be silent. Also, Pierre Lebossier from the Haiti Action Committee gives us an update on the growing resistance to U.S.-inspired violence against the Haitian people. And our regular segment, Food Fight, with Keith McHenry from Food Not Bombs. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. We are live today in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we are happy to have you along. And we begin taking a look at what's been going on in terms of the Korean Peninsula. We know, for instance, you know, if you listen to any corporate mainstream press, that North Korea has been testing a variety of ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and hypersonic missiles. And they've been doing various tests that some have actually been fired over Japan. But what is the United States doing? What's it look like on the ground there? What's the situation? What's the history here? What do we really need to know? What's missing in this picture? Joining us to talk about that is somebody who knows a good deal about what has been going on there. She's the advocacy director, works with Women Cross DMZ, Women Cross DMZ, and we are happy to welcome Colleen Moore. Welcome, Colleen, to Flashpoints.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me tonight.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Could you just say a little bit about what Women Cross the DMZ is about, its origins?
Yes. So Women Cross DMZ is a global movement of women mobilizing for peace on the Korean Peninsula. We got our start back in 2015, where we led a crossing of international prominent women peace activists from North Korea to South Korea, starting with a symposium in Pyongyang and ending with a conference in Seoul. To call for peace, women-led movement for peace. And since then, we kind of divide up into three different areas that we focus on, so advocacy, organizing, and education. So my role, of course, in advocacy, I am really advocating in the U.S. Congress for legislation that calls for a different approach to North Korea. For decades, the U.S. has tried the same thing over and over again with North Korea, has pursued the same policies of pressure and sanction and isolation, and clearly it has not worked. So Women Cross DMZ is calling for something new. So specifically what I'm doing is advocating for a bill called the Peace on the Korean Peninsula Act in Congress. And we also have a grassroots movement of multiple chapters across the U.S. and every region of the U.S. mobilizing to call for peace with North Korea. So that's a little bit about our background and what we do.
Well, there's so much that folks in this country don't know about Korea, about the Koreas, about North Korea and South Korea, and the fact that the United States is still at war with Korea, for instance. Mm-hmm. Could you try and give us a perspective of what it might look like in the North, given the extent and the amount of military practice, huge military practice sessions that have really caused some folks to not trust what's going on and really created dissension between North and South, got in the way of any kind of sort of attempt at reunification. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So as you mentioned, the Korean War never ended. Technically, active hostilities ended in 1953 with an armistice agreement between North Korea and the United States, but this fragile armistice agreement is barely holding. It was never replaced by a real peace agreement as was originally intended. So from our point of view, the unresolved state of the war is the root cause of tensions and hostilities between the two parties. And so from North Korea's perspective, you know, I think the U.S. needs to see where they are coming from, where the North Korean government is coming from in order to resolve this impasse, because they really see their nuclear arsenal as a security guarantee almost, and they really want security guarantees in order to remove its nuclear deterrent, which we see a peace agreement could provide in order to start negotiations again on nuclear disarmament. Because like I said before, clearly what the U.S. is doing is failing. It's only exacerbated the situation. We can, you know, trace negotiations breaking down between North Korea and the U.S. to the unending state of war. There's been many times, especially during the six-party talks under President George Bush in the mid-2000s, that, you know, they were close to reaching an agreement, but it always came back to, look, we're in a state of war with you. We can't, for example, provide the exact number of nuclear weapons or, you know, describe exactly what our nuclear arsenal looks like. You are an enemy state. So we really see this as the root cause of the security crisis between the two parties. And without a peace agreement, renewed conflict could break out at any time. The North Koreans have clearly concluded that bolstering their nuclear arsenal is their ticket to ensuring its security. So we really call on the Biden administration to address this point directly and move away from, at best, ignoring North Korea and hoping things will change on their own. The Biden administration came back today and said, you know, we want engagement, but until we get back to the table, we'll just have to rely on deterrence. And we can't just sit here and wait for things to change without actually putting anything on the table.
Now, there's this policy referred to as the pivot or the Pacific pivot. And it really has been passed through several U.S. administrations. And it really is about, if I understand this correctly, it's about essentially surrounding China by land, air, sea, and space. I mean, enter U.S.'s new space division of the military and its latest generation of sort of intercontinental, not intercontinental ballistic missiles, but moves to control space. Let's just put it that way. Do you think with this kind of policy very clearly being articulated by the United States and supported by its allies, that this is going to make any kind of real lasting peace problematic?
Yes, absolutely. I think that this great power competition and this pivot to Asia that the U.S. is focusing on, it, I mean, the Korean Peninsula is a powder keg in the midst of all of this. I think that, you know, the U.S. focus is primarily on competing with China, and this zero-sum strategy toward China is so narrow-minded, and it limits space for cooperation, engenders a cycle of provocations that could escalate, and it really is unclear what the end goal of this strategy is. It's reactionary and simply revolves around trying to undermine any actions of China, and it's not proactive, and very similar to the North Korea policy that I mentioned. It's simply reactive and very militaristic, and they keep going round and round on these escalations without actually considering the effects on impacted communities. So I think North Korea at the center of this, it's become so intertwined, the policy toward China and North Korea. The Department of Defense released their global posture review last year, where they explicitly said they were moving resources to the Asia Pacific to deter China and North Korea. It always seems that North Korea seems to be lumped in with China. And they also announced a new operational war plan toward North Korea that would include mobilizing allies like South Korea for the purpose of deterring China. And again, North Korea is always a part of that. We're also seeing it in the U.S. Congress as well. There was this massive bill that ended up collapsing. It became the U.S. Chips and Science Act, but it was originally the Innovation and Competition Act. And it was a bill on U.S. manufacturing, but it was all couched in how do we compete with China? How do we beat China? For some reason, the Senate version included an amendment on North Korea and maximum economic pressure. So we do really see that the U.S.'s overall posture towards East Asia is dangerous and, like you said, will undermine efforts for peace. And kind of your first question on, you know, where is North Korea coming from? The U.S. continues to say that they have no hostility toward North Korea, but North Korea sees that they're surrounded by a sea of U.S. allies who have been recruited to deter China and North Korea. They're seeing sanctions and new war plans, the escalating military exercises. So it is clearly antithetical to peace, and we are not authentically engaged in an approach that would actually lead to peace and stability. And the Biden administration, you know, in rhetoric said at the beginning of their administration that that was their end goal, but clearly their policies do not actually match this rhetoric. So, yeah, overall, as these tensions start to increase between U.S. and China, we can definitely see heightened tensions in Korea, and they're definitely caught in the middle of this great power competition.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Colleen Moore. She's with Women Cross DMZ. And we're talking about the latest flare-up in tensions between the United States and North Korea. North Korea has been doing some long-distance missile tests, one over Japan. I'm thinking, though, the contradictions are massive. But I'm thinking about the United States, you know, has to sort of go on triple war alert if North Koreans do a test. But the United States has already tested a new generation of nuclear weapons mm-hmm. that have made our world more dangerous now than it has ever been before. We've been testing the hell out mm-hmm. of weapons, above ground, below ground. We've blown up our own people. We've tested throughout the world and destroyed other people's lifestyles and ways to live with our tests. I mean, it is, I guess it's sort of like the North Koreans are refusing to just essentially lay down, right? As they see. But it would be, there was progress. Things were moving in a good direction. And then, you know, you alluded to this, and then it fell apart. It did seem like the United States was hell bent on making sure that the sort of the expanding relations. You were with women in DMZ. You were making progress. That was part of your whole one of your major actions was sort of this uniting of North and South. Right. This is what your group is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And as you talked about with the progress that was being made with diplomacy back under Trump and in 2018, 2019, there were a lot of positive things that came out of it. You know, after the 2019 Singapore Declaration, President Trump and Kim Jong-un pledged to establish new relations and to build a lasting and stable peace regime. And after that, you know, the U.S. canceled a joint military exercise with South Korea. North Korea blew up one of their nuclear testing sites. They self-imposed a moratorium on nuclear and long-range tests, which lasted until earlier this year. And I will also say North Korea released three detained Americans and repatriated the remains of U.S. service members from the Korean War as well. So a lot of positives came out of that diplomacy, but we do really see this clear inverse correlation between the progress of USDPRK diplomacy and this alarming arms race. North Korea has said time and time again it will match power for power and goodwill for goodwill. And since that diplomacy has stalled, we have seen renewed missile tests. And I don't think we should see any of this as a surprise. I think after the Hanoi summit collapsed in 2019, I mean, it collapsed because maximum pressure, because Trump and his national security advisor, John Bolton, at the last minute resorted back to maximum economic pressure. And that is a non-starter for North Korea of denuclearization upfront for sanctions relief. And they were making progress, and there were so many positive things that came out of diplomacy. But I think that North Korea now sees, like, why would we offer anything like that to get back to the table? We offered, you know, Yongbyon, to shut down Yongbyon for certain concessions, and, you know, that collapsed. So why would they go out of their way right now? And I think it's really up to the U.S. to offer certain confidence-building measures. And there are things that they could easily put on the table. They could scale back the military exercises that have been ramping up this year. They could offer very specific or more general sanctions relief. They could you know, really authentically engage in this peace-first approach that I've been talking about, of approaching them with the idea for a peace agreement. But it's very clear that they're not prepared to do that, unfortunately, and we're just seeing it get worse, and we see this inverse relationship between the lack of diplomacy and the arms race escalating.
Do you think the obvious upsurge in China bashing makes it more difficult for there to be relations, peaceful relations, productive relations between the United States and North Korea? It does seem since the pandemic, there has been certainly bipartisan agreement on one thing, and that is China bashing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So with this U.S.-China competition, U.S.-China competition, the U.S. is really trying to rope in their allies like South Korea and Japan as its military front against China. And this increases the threat perception in North Korea, of course, which is leading to even more of an escalation on the Korean Peninsula. And so U.S. efforts to convince South Korea particularly to join its front against China, very dangerous zero-sum approach that really cements Cold War divisions in the region and risk military confrontation among, you know, the great powers that are nuclear armed. And I think ending the Korean War could kind of disrupt this great power competition. It could pave the way toward greater cooperation between not only the U.S. and China, but the U.S. and North Korea on so many different issues. And specifically, if, you know, China has said that they are committed to ending the Korean War, and it may not be legally necessary, their participation in the signing of a Korea peace agreement, but it might be politically necessary. It could help to pave the way for greater regional peace and security. You know, China would lose justification for increasing their military capabilities in the region if we are able to end the Korean War in the U.S. and North Korea, normalize relations. It would address North Korean security concerns, and then the U.S. and South Korea on our side would also lose justification for ramping up these military escalations, the military exercises, continuing sanctions, and then, of course, reevaluating in the long term the presence of U.S. troops in South Korea. So, yes, to answer your question, absolutely, it makes it much harder, but we do see the potential for Korea peace as disrupting this, because continuing U.S. tensions with China, this zero-sum game that clearly does not have an end goal other than beating China, but nobody really knows what that means. And it could just simply lead to a massive great power war where, you know, the U.S. and China are brought in. If some kind of military escalation starts in Korea, the U.S. and China are legally brought in because of treaties that they each have. So I think we really need to understand what's at stake and how much these U.S.-China deteriorating relations is really going to affect the region, and especially on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, that's very helpful, really good information. I want to thank you very much for taking the time out and being with us, Colleen Moore, working with a wonderful group. If people want more information about Women Cross DMZ, what's the best way to do that? How can they follow your work and the work of the group?
Yes, absolutely. So our website is womencrossdmz.org. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at womencrossdmz. We also have a Korea Peace Now campaign, which is our international campaign with our South Korean partners, our women's organization partners in South Korea. And so you can also find us at Korea Peace Now on Twitter and Instagram, and KoreaPeaceNow.org. And as part of this international campaign, we have grassroots chapters across the country. So I know that this radio show is in California. We have LA and San Francisco Bay Area chapters. You can find on our website, our Korea Peace Now website, on how to get involved. And I will also just make a quick plug. There is a documentary out about our crossing back in 2015. The documentary is called Crossings, and it is currently being screened around the country. So there is a screening coming to San Francisco in a few weeks. I believe it's on the 25th in San Francisco. And so if you go to our website, womencrossdmz.org, you can find the information there to attend that screening and learn more about our movement and how to get involved.
Well, that is terrific, Colleen Moore. We really appreciate the good information. We hope that we can talk to you again sometime soon. Please stay safe.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
You're so welcome. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break and then come back with our segment, Food Fight, the battle for fighting for a house and for some food to eat in this country. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We welcome back to these airwaves Food Fight. And Food Fight is Keith McHenry, founder of Food Not Bombs. He's been fighting to feed people, and that's really what it comes down to. It's a fight, Keith, for you to be able to have the right to feed the growing numbers of hungry people in this country who are also being more and more being forced out into the streets. Things are not getting better. And things, I'm afraid, Keith, are about to get a bit worse in terms of the economy, food, and all that stuff. This is all going to affect your work as well, isn't it?
Yeah, we're already seeing an increased need here in Santa Cruz. And it's just, you know, from the entire time we've been talking for months now, years, it gets worse and worse and worse. And now, you know, this, the U.S. Bureau of Census Bureau says that 3.8 million American families are expected to be evicted in October. And you can see people clinging on, and then instead of like instead of addressing that crisis, they're our city, and I know many cities are involved in just driving the homeless, you know, out of camps at, with no place for anybody to go. And then the anti-homeless rhetoric on places like Nextdoor.com and by city officials and so on, and new anti-homeless laws and laws restricting the sharing of food are increasing at a time when the opposite should be happening.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit about what the daily struggle has been for you. You've been doing this. You founded Food Not Bombs, which is an international organization, and so I know you're in touch with folks everywhere. But tell us a little bit about your daily struggle, because that tells us a lot about what's going on in other places.
Yeah, so 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, there we blocked the what we called the holiday evictions of about 150 unhoused people camping in a park. And they ended up moving into a floodplain in that same park, and they've been there for at least 2 years. And the city decided they would do a phase sweep of the camp. So they are clearing it out in six sections at a time. It had gotten to the point where it was probably in the area of about 400 to 500 people living there, because if you were caught living outside in the city of Santa Cruz, the cops would send you to this camp. And for instance, when they evicted the seniors out of the last COVID hotel, the Oceana, the county just handed them a pup tent and sent them to the benchlands. And at that same time they were doing that, they were evicting everybody out of the only shelter in town, the Armory, and closed it down and put 60 people out in the street. So in the end of June, over 100 people were forced into the streets and told to go to the benchlands. And now those people's belongings are all being destroyed, thrown away. The people are scurrying away. It's heartbreaking. And now the individuals that had found safety being in community in this huge camp, which looked a lot like the shanties I'd been in Kenya and Nairobi, they now are in doorways. And the frightening thing is, a very dear friend of ours who'd been eating with us for years and years used to bring me the most unusual pieces of wire as gifts or little things he found on the street, and he would hand them to me as though they were emeralds or diamonds, you know. And he ended up, sadly, two teenagers beat him up and then crushed his head with their and videotaped themselves doing it. And this is now our biggest concern, is because the people are now in the doorways and they're by themselves and have no protection at the same time as the anti-homeless rhetoric. It's just getting ramped up, and you could see from the violence of the city against the people in the benchlands, it's just reinforcing this idea that the people who live outside are not human, and therefore you could do whatever you want to them. And you can see there's also like a serial murder of unhoused people in Stockton right now. And this kind of violence against unhoused people is continuing, and I think there's a direct relationship to that in the call for war. And the threats of nuclear war by both the U.S. and Russia against each other. I'd never seen so many people just screaming into the sky downtown. Everywhere you went, people were just like going mad. And I don't know whether it's the war hysteria or that everybody's been displaced and they don't know where to go now and don't know what to do. Because they're just wandering the streets with their belongings. And you can see virtually every doorway has little camps in them now of two, three people trying to, you know, waiting to get kicked out by the police in the morning. And it's just, it's not, you know, when we're going to double the homeless population in our community, this is no way to solve the problem. And what I think is one of the most horrible things about what the city has done, because they've had 2 years to gracefully move people to safe, you know, parks or camps or whatever they would do, or I used to provide addresses of abandoned apartment complexes and empty hotel, entire hotels, and they got, you know, millions and millions of dollars to buy or rent these places, and they did not do it. And currently our city government has $12 million still available to help somebody that, you know, that was given to by the state to help the homeless. But all we know is that of the 14 total million dollars, they've already spent $1 million on getting rid of the homeless out of the bench lands, and they spent another $1 million on salaries of people to manage that, you know, their homeless programs. Oh. But there's nothing from homeless people.
So we're just about out of time, but if people in the Bay Area, people who are perhaps near you or in other places in this world where Food Not Bombs might be, what's the best way for them to get a little bit of help, get a meal while they still might be able to?
Yeah, well, I just got off the phone with somebody from Dallas looking for food. They can go to foodnotbombs.net, and we have the hunger hotline, and that is becoming really tragic, the stories we're getting on that hotline. So 211 often gives out that our number, 1-800-884-1136, and every one of our chapters are stretched. And then today, I have 8 people ask for pup tents this today, and I, you know, gave out 8 pup tents, and I've still got a couple more left for tomorrow. But that's, you know, just the, we're like trying to raise money all the time for pup tents, blankets, let alone the increased amount of resources we need just to feed people. And you know, we are trying to get to a point where, you know, we are stockpiling as much food as we can in shipping containers and so on to make sure that we can meet this huge, huge need if there's interruptions in access to food, which we anticipate, as Joe Biden had said earlier in the conflict with Russia, that there would be food.
I can tell you just from an observation in my neighborhood, it's interesting, the bank closed down and now it's a perfect place for a couple of homeless folks to move right in. And it's amazing how fast that happens and how you can see what's happening in the neighborhood. And I'm seeing more and more people on the streets where I live now. And it's, you know, so Keith, you've always been really on the cutting edge of this work. We're short on time today, but obviously we're going to come back. We're going to keep our dialogue going, and we appreciate the work you've been doing at Food Not Bombs. What is this, 40 years?
It'll be 43 years on May 24th. Yep.
43 years. You're amazing, Keith.
We've done 1,000. It'll be 1,000 days that we have met the needs of people in Santa Cruz when the other soup kitchens were down or handing out bag lunches. That'll be on the December 10th. We will have been out there for 1,000 days straight without missing, all volunteer and without any permission from the government. In fact, 8 evictions by the government, 2 by developers and 2 by the county during the entire 1,000 days.
All right. Listen, I got to jump now, Keith. We'll talk to you soon. Okay. Be safe.
Thank you so much, Dennis. Okay,
bye-bye. Take care. Bye. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are going to take a nice musical break, and then when we come back, we're going to be joined by a very good friend of this program, Pierre Lebeausier, and we're going to be talking about Haiti. And we've been talking about Haiti on this show for 30 years, and we're going to keep the dialogue going. It's more important now than ever that we get the information out. Stay with us. We'll be back in a sec.
Thank you.
That was Sefi Zizelin, Welcome Sunset on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Lovely music, difficult day, particularly for people living in Haiti, particularly because the United States government decided for some reason they could not let this free black nation be free, and the United States has been, in one way or another, undermining the right of the Haitian people towards self-determination forever. But they continue, the battles continue, the situation now on the streets in the country, in the countryside, is intense. Joining us to talk about it is our good friend, our old friend, Pierre Lebossier. He is with the Haiti Action Committee. And Pierre, well, welcome back to Flashpoints. I think I want you to take a couple of minutes and just give a little context for people who don't know a lot about Haiti, how it got to this point where there is essentially a failed state as a result of U.S. foreign policy.
Yes, thank you, Dennis, and I appreciate your having me once again. Really very thankful for your having me once again on the show. You started it correctly. Haiti, for people who don't know, and I've heard the term, Haiti is a country in the Caribbean. We share the island with the Dominican Republic. And Haiti was a land where the French colonizers mistreated our people, brutalized them, and really made tons of money, great wealth for the French, for France, on the backs of our foremothers and forefathers who were worked to death, literally. And so people rebelled in 1791, massive rebellion, which led to a 13-year war with periods of peace here and there, but really 13 years of war, which involved also Britain and Spain. And the Africans who had freed themselves defeated those nations, including eventually France, the troops of Napoleon Bonaparte, and Haiti declared itself an independent nation. And why I want to go there is to give people a sense of the history. So that was in 1804, the second country in the Western Hemisphere, right after the U.S., to declare itself independent. And Haiti not only declared itself independent, but declared the abolition of slavery, totally and completely. And also, very importantly, declared itself a sanctuary nation for Africans who would be, who would free themselves or who would make their way to Haiti, and once touching Haitian soil, they would not be recognized as enslaved people. They would be free men and free women, and would be granted Haitian citizenship, and also people of indigenous origin, because the Africans of Haiti knew the history of the land, and they knew that it was the genocide, the wars of genocide and the conquest by the Spanish, the French, and the English that stole the land. So they paid tribute to the people who were there and to their descendants, and said once they touch Haitian soil, they would become Haitian citizens. So this could not be accepted by the slave powers of the time, and Haiti was completely surrounded by powerful nations, by empires, really, that became great as a result of slavery. And so they sought from that very time to destroy Haiti. And during the 19th century, the entire 1800s was based on Haiti trying to maintain its independence and trying to survive in this hostile world surrounded by empires based on slavery. And Haiti helped a number of countries free themselves from slavery. I like to mention Simon Bolivar, and I also like to mention that Cuba, there was a lot of support for the Cubans as they were fighting for independence. Jose Marti used to come and meet clandestinely in Haiti with some of his comrades from the island, and so on. But by the U.S. became more directly involved with Haiti, and I need to mention that the New York Times had an article called The Ransom, It was a series of articles, and it talked about the money that France extorted from Haiti. France didn't do that on its own. It had the full support of the U.S. to make the formerly enslaved population who had gotten their freedom at the price of big, big sacrifices to make them pay reparations to the former enslavers. And so...
Really? They paid. Oh, yeah. They were forced to pay reparations to their former slave owners?
Exactly. At the tune at the time of 150 million gold francs, which was later reduced to 90 million gold francs, which President Aristide calculated it in 2003, it was about 27, close to 28 billion, I'm sorry, 20, close to $22 billion, which
in current, from, yeah.
From 2003 to the present, a French economist recalculated the amount and said it's closer to $28 billion. So President Aristide had demanded that the French return this money to us. So that severely impacted the development of the country. And the French had the support of the U.S., Britain, Spain, all of them. You see, because they couldn't stand for this example of enslaved people being victorious and destroying this institution of slavery, beginning the destruction of this institution that was bringing them so much wealth. And so, and Haiti supported the movement for the for independence in the Dominican Republic. And it's very curious, the use of racism, Dennis. One thing I want to mention about this as a background, there were also troops that Napoleon had sent from Poland and from conscripts from Poland and Germany. And at that time, many of those European troops were fighting for their own freedom in Europe. And so when they reached the soil of Haiti, they became politicized as to the true nature of the struggle. And many of them defected from Napoleon and turned their guns against the troops of Napoleon, joining with the Africans. See, they don't like to mention that in the history books as an example of how people coming together around issues when they realize that they are being lied to. And so they use racism to divide people. That's what I was
and
mentioning.
This is, you know, Pierre, and this is like all a part of the nature of banning books and what gets written into the textbooks, the you know, those all those textbooks that are produced in Texas, and this history. I had to be a teacher, you know, I was a teacher of young kids, and I had to really write my own curriculum if I wanted to really be able to teach about Haiti or any other sort of thing, particularly having to do with history and economics and stuff like that. But this is so revealing. Let's see if we can fast forward a little bit. Maybe you can
mention something real quick. The reason I bring this up is just to illustrate this, the racism that happens. For example, Spain had continued slavery in what is today the Dominican Republic, but at that time it was a colony of Spain. Haiti helped the Dominicans, the people who today are the Dominican citizens of the Dominican Republic. Haiti helped them defeat Spain, abolishing slavery there in 1822. And later on in 1862, when there was a final struggle against Spanish colonialism there, Haiti sent troops and helped the Dominicans win their independence. But that is not celebrated as Dominican Independence Day, you see. So there is this kind of overpowering thing with the ideology of the dominant class, of the ruling elite, that plagues us, not only in the islands, not only in Latin America, but also right here in the U.S. So, I'm sorry, but I wanted to bring that out.
No, that's very important. We're speaking with Pierre Lavoisier. He's with the Haiti Action Committee. He's a longtime friend of this show. We're talking about his country, his homeland of Haiti, which is continually has been for decades, hundreds of years, over 100 years of sort of torture and control. And now the situation has, because of U.S. foreign policy, destabilization policy, the country's in real trouble. And meanwhile, the United States is busy deporting hundreds and hundreds of people back to Haiti in the middle of what's going on already in the streets. Bring us up to date. Bring us up to speed. How can you describe the situation? What's going on now? What's it like to be in Haiti now?
Yeah, it's been since 1914, it's been 108 years of direct U.S. intervention in Haiti. Not only intervention for 19 years, as they like to call it, but presence, dominance of the U.S. continuously. And so from that time on to the present, Haiti has known nothing but the people of Haiti, I should say, the majority population has known nothing but exploitation, chaos, land grabs, following the U.S. invasion in 1915 when there was a massive uprising of the people of Haiti who were opposed to the land grabs of the big plantations that were inserting and stealing the people's land to establish a new system of big plantation in Haiti, controlled by the multinational. People rebelled, the peasants fought. Close to 20,000 were massacred, not only by the U.S. Marines, in line with a newly created Haitian military created by the U.S. to impose this system of exploitation. So the reason I went back, because it's the same thing that's going on today. It's been an uninterrupted war against the people of Haiti. And so the refugee issue that we are seeing today dates back to those times when at the time many Haitians had to flee Haiti, had to flee the aerial bombardments, had to flee the massive killings of the people who were protesting, the land grabs, their mistreatment, the brutal, the racist abuses that they were receiving in Haiti, the atrocities. And so that whole refugee thing, what we are seeing today, is a continuation of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. presence in Haiti. And so,
go ahead, please.
And so today, what we are seeing is that this has continued. People know about Haiti when they hear they mention Papa Doc and Baby Doc Duvalier. People know about, not too much, but they hear about it. So Papa Doc and Baby Doc Duvalier were among the most well-known dictators that Haiti has had over that period of, I would call, the American century in regards to Haiti. And so what they have done is maintaining the system. And today, as people are rising up, there is an uprising all over the country. Unarmed men, women, and children are in the streets, are in the small communities, in the rural areas, saying enough of this exploitation, enough with the land grabs, enough with the kidnappings that are being carried out by so-called gangs, but who are nothing but death squads, who what they are doing is kidnapping people and extorting money from their relatives so they don't kill them, in a way reminiscent of what happened during the slave trade back in the colonial days, way back in Africa. And Haitians are outraged by this, and they are being supported. These so-called gangs, but death squads, are being supported by none other than the Haitian government and doing the bidding of the U.S. and the U.N. occupation that has been in Haiti since the coup of 2004.
Wow. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Pierre Lavoisier, and we are talking about Haiti. Pierre, we have to just talk a little bit about the brutality. We've talked about it before, but it's really important. People are forced out of the country, and then they're kidnapped in this country and forced back into the country. The deportations continue of Haitians. The deportations continue nonstop. And people who get deported back to Haiti are definitely facing a possible death. They could easily be killed. And there are struggles around this on a daily basis, right?
Yes, yes. And, you know, Dennis, this is another heartless and brutal abuse or interaction between the U.S., the United Nations, the countries that call themselves the core group, or they used to call themselves Friends of Haiti. We are talking about nine mostly European countries, but they have included, they include Brazil. Brazil is thrown in there to give it a little color, you know, to make sure it's people of color are in it too. But basically these nine entities, and let me spell them out, it's Canada, France, the U.S., England, Germany, and Spain, the representatives of those countries, including you have entities such as the Organization of American States, the United Nations, the European Union, they form a consortium of entities, international entities, that are managing the daily affairs of Haiti. When I say manage, let me say it another way, that are dictating to this puppet Ariel Henry, to this lackey of imperialism who was imposed on the people of Haiti by the U.S. and the U.N. occupation as prime minister, who doesn't care a hoot about what the people are going through. Kidnappings are taking place, people being burned alive by the death squads. In the month of July, in Cité Soleil, 500 people, over 500, were killed by the so-called gangs. But the gangs were very close, worked very closely with the police, just like the Tonton Macoutes of the Duvalier era, just like La Métis Manchette, which is the little machete army that was working hand in hand with the Haitian police and the UN forces right after the coup of 2004, when people were in the streets protesting. The gangs today are very much the same way. And that's why I say gang slash death squad, because that's what they are. They are there to terrorize the population. And so what you have is a situation where they prevent people from protesting, but in spite of all of this, in spite of that repression, people take to the streets and they are protesting. They are demanding their rights. They are saying enough with the land grabs. They are going after people, people who have land in areas particularly where areas where the land, there might be some gold or copper or marble on their land or petroleum, Haiti has petroleum. People are being run off their land by these so-called gangs who are working with a number of very, very rich families in Haiti, according to many, to what the people are saying on the streets. It's not me saying it, it's the people saying it. And so that's what is going on the ground. And so, but people are determined. They said our ancestors have fought for this land, they have fought for their freedom way back. We will continue to fight because we have nowhere to go.
Who's in the streets now? Who would we find in the streets now protesting? What would be on the sign, if you will?
Well, because the traditional media, what I mean by that, in powerful elite media, elite control media in Haiti, do not really show too much of that. People are taking their cell phones and making videos and sending them out. And so what you would find are children. For example, school was supposed to start last week. Many school children put their uniform on and they went in the streets. They said, we cannot go to school not until Ariel Henry, that lackey so-called prime minister, is gone from power, not until the system is reversed. So you'll find children, youth in the streets. You'll find women, mothers with their children in the streets, men, fathers in the streets, whole families, despite the fact that the police is killing people and who participate in the demonstrations. and beating them, you know, using all kinds of instruments and shooting them in the head. So that's what, and these are the people who are saying enough. We are tired of the high prices. We are tired that our tax money, people in Haiti are heavily, heavily taxed. And in addition to the regular taxes that the government takes, they also have to pay money to the so-called gangs or death squads. You see, many of the women merchants, the men merchants, people, shopkeepers or what have you, they have to pay money to them on top of all the money, the taxes that they have to pay. But they get no services in return. When, if you are sick, you have to go to the hospital. Unless you bring your own gauze and supplies, you won't get treatment, you know? And many of these hospitals are closing. So a number of services, sanitation, garbage, that's not picked up. It's not picked up. The services aren't provided yet. All these officials of the government, they are, for the most part, most of them are ripping off the state treasury and taking the money, buying fancy homes abroad, or investing. In no time flat, they become millionaires. And this is all connected with the US-UN occupation, which continues to impose these people on us and are protecting them and giving them a lot of impunity, regardless of their crimes. This is what's going on.
It is absolutely horrible. We're lucky to have you and be able to share this information with folks who listen to the Pacifica Radio Network and listen to Flashpoints. I'm sure we've been doing this story since the first day we did this show about 35 years ago. And the situation, how many years, how many decades have we been saying it can't get worse? And it does, and it really is a result of, one, U.S. hegemony, and two, the fact that the inability, we're lucky that we have you, Pierre, and we have Kevin Pina and some of the other folks who give us the information that makes a difference. But the story of Haiti, the real story of Haiti and the U.S. relationship with Haiti is not clear, is not taught in the schools in a way that people can understand what has been going on. It needs to be taught. There needs to be a truth commission on U.S. policy towards yes. Haiti. But final word, Pierre?
Yes, you know, it's a word of solidarity, again, and I say it, and the reason why I repeat the story, it's because we are bombarded, when I say we, meaning the whole world is bombarded with propaganda from these people who are killing our sisters and brothers in Haiti, from these forces that are super exploiting people. And so they tell us, well, Haiti is a failed state, it's this, it's that. Well, it's been 18 years of a United Nations occupation of Haiti, the U.S. hiding behind the United Nations to impose this hellish situation, which is hellish for the people of Haiti, but many multinationals and individuals are making tons of money out of it. And yet they say, well, the Haitians can't govern themselves, but it's not true. One of the things is that they have set up, Dennis, and I'll try to make this very, very fast.
We just have 15 seconds, but go on.
Yeah, it's the call by the Lackey Prime Minister for boots on the ground. What it means is that a reinforced military intervention. We know what that means. It means more massacres of the Haitian people. And the Haitian people will be massacred again as they were doing before, as they continue to do, but this time with more firepower.
So you do not support U.S. troops on the ground again. All right, we're going to, obviously, Pierre Lebossier, Haiti Action Committee. I'm Dennis Bernstein. We're going to keep on this story. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listener-supported community radio.
sure to tune into Radio Lost and Found, where many radio mysteries will be revealed. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour mediascape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more, coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.